This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Wallace is famous for the two-fisted interview style that he developed on 60 Minutes. In his new memoir, Between You and Me, he writes about some of his most dramatic interviews. An accompanying DVD features excerpts of those interviews, like this one with Malcolm X, which Wallace did for the CBS Morning News in 1964, after Malcolm X had become disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad's leadership of the black Muslims.
Do you feel, perhaps, that you should now take over the leadership of the black Muslims?
No, I have no desire to take over the leadership of the black Muslims, and I have never had that desire. But I do have this desire. I have a desire to see the Afro-American in this country get the human rights that are his due, to make a complete human being.
Are you the least bit afraid of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
8 months after that interview, Malcolm X was assassinated. In 1975, Mike Wallace interviewed Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who guarded President Kennedy when he was assassinated. Hill had retired shortly before the interview was recorded, but you can hear that he's still devastated.
Can I take you back to November 22nd in 1963? You were on the fender of the Secret Service car, right behind President Kennedy's car. At the first shot, you ran forward and jumped on the back of the president's car in less than 2 seconds, pulling Mrs. Kennedy down into her seat, protecting her. But first of all, she was out on the trunk of that car.
She was out of the back seat of that car. Not out of the trunk of that car.
Well, she had climbed out of the back and she was on the way back, right?
And because of the fact that her husband's head had been shot off and gone off to the street.
She wasn't trying to climb out of the car. She was...
No. She was simply trying to reach that head, part of the head.
To bring it back.
That's the only thing.
Was there anything that the Secret Service or that Clint Hill could have done to keep that from happening?
Clint Hill, yes.
Clint Hill, yes? What do you mean?
If he had reacted about 5/10 of a second faster, or maybe a second faster, I wouldn't be here today.
You mean you would have gotten there and you would have taken the shot?
The third shot, yes, sir.
And that would have been all right with you?
That would have been fine with me.
It's an excerpt of the DVD accompanying Mike Wallace's new book. Wallace has been with 60 Minutes since the show's inception in 1968. Although he's nearly 88, he's retired from full participation in the show, but he still does some segments for it. Let's go to the very beginning of your career. Your initial goal was to be a radio announcer?
That's correct. And I was turned down in Muskegon, Michigan, when I got out of Ann Arbor, where I went to school, University of Michigan, and as a result, I eventually auditioned at WOOD in Grand Rapids, and the program manager hired me for $20 a week, and I was in heaven. And that's what launched it all. All I wanted to be at that time was a radio announcer.
Well, what was your job when you first got the job as radio announcer?
Well, as a radio announcer, I read, rip, and read news.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't a reporter. I was reading The Wire. And the other thing was, I was reading commercials, and I could do a hell of a commercial. And I did exceedingly well. I used to announce, "The Green Hornet Rides Again," or "The Challenge of the Yukon," or... Occasionally, I was the announcer on The Lone Ranger.
Locally or nationally, like for the national show?
Nationally, out of Detroit. WXYZ in Detroit, Michigan.
So you would take us to those thrilling days of yesteryear?
That's exactly right. And I was good friends with Brace Beamer, who was the man who played The Lone Ranger, and took it very seriously.
Did you work on your voice in those days? Did you take voice lessons or,
you know something?
Try to deepen it?
I I had a, I've not thought about this forever, Louise Hannon was a speech teacher at the University of Michigan, and she used to put her, she said, here's how to produce a proper voice. And she put her hand on my belly and on my back, and she said, the voice is supposed, I didn't know what was on her mind, really, and she said, look, produce your voice from down here. And she pressed my belly. And the fact of the matter is, that's how I learned to develop a voice. And it became a kind of distinctive voice. And particularly when there's not too much phlegm down there, it remains at the age of 87 a voice that's worth listening to.
Now, in 1949, under the name Myron Wallace, you hosted a program called Majority Rules. What was the show?
It was a quiz show. It was...
This was still radio?
This was radio. Well, it was not television. Bergen, Dr. Bergen Evans, who was a professor of English at Northwestern University, was the star of the show, and I was the moderator, and he would have a variety of I forget exactly what. Can you imagine? You're just a child, so you don't have the problem that I have.
I'm still in my crib. Yeah.
At the age of 87, I swear it's astonishing how much I have forgotten. And cannot remember.
Well, let me ask you about that, actually, because I think that the issue of memory is such an interesting issue, particularly for someone who's either a historian or a journalist, because part of what you've devoted your life to is recording. I mean, what you've devoted your life to is recording things, recording people, talking about events that have shaped their lives or the world. And you have that on history, and some of that history is in your book and in the accompanying DVD. Then, of course, in your own mind, like the rest of us, the mind and the memory, they're imperfect. So you've recorded all these things, but then you start to forget them.
Yes,
so
I know.
Does it make you think that memory, that like tape and DVDs are great, but that memory is futile because eventually you start forgetting all those things you worked so hard to remember?
Look, to reach for a name, to reach for an event. I had a fall. I fell off a jetty out in Martha's Vineyard and landed on my head. And I was standing and slipped. And it was brutal and bloody. And I woke up. I don't know how long I was out. But that really, I'm convinced, had something to do with losing my memory. When you have that kind of a blow to the head, I hate to think about it. It really does something to your memory. And then you add age to that. And then you begin to hear less and see double. Ah, you're a very fortunate person to be how old?
Me? Let's do the math. 54.
You're 54?
Mm-hmm.
You got the voice of a... It's a beautiful voice.
Oh, well, thank you.
And at least 25 years younger than that.
So when was this fall?
It was 2-3 summers ago. Really.
But you're still doing some work on 60 Minutes, right?
Yes. I have two profiles coming up on 60 Minutes. And, you know, I'm down to doing maybe half a dozen, 8 pieces a year because I've been there for... What is it, 36, 37 years? Harry Reasoner and I started it along with Don Hewitt back in 1968.
Now, let me get back to your early career, test that memory a little bit. Shows that you hosted included Majority Rules, Guess Again, All Around the Town, and Mike and Buff. They sound like great shows. So these were all radio?
Well, Mike and Buff was radio and television.
Well, it was so good they simulcast it.
No. No. We did it on CBS in the afternoons on the radio, and then they decided, hey, why don't we put the two of them? Buff was my wife.
Oh.
Back then.
Oh.
And what we did was, one of the characteristics of the show was that we were the Bickersons, in that we used to bicker about things on the air that people found entertaining. The kind of back and forth that used to go on husband and wife shows back then. Unfortunately for us, the bickering that was on the air eventually turned real. And so after a while, the bickering continued at home. And so eventually, we bickered ourselves out of a job.
And a marriage.
That's correct.
My guest is Mike Wallace. He has a new memoir called Between You and Me. It comes with a DVD that includes excerpts of the interviews he writes about. You started off doing quiz shows. You did some acting, announcing, commercials. You eventually get to 60 Minutes and become...
Well, yeah, wait.
We're missing a lot here. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was I didn't feel that I was properly earning my keep. I used to say, look, I do these commercials and I do this drama and this sort of thing and the rip and read news, and I was doing the air edition of the Chicago Sun and the air edition of the Chicago Sun Times after a while and so forth. I wanted to be more legitimate. I got interested in, obviously I had been interested in news, and what happened was that I lost a son. He fell off a mountain in Greece. His name was Peter. Wonderful boy. Good writer. Wanted to be a reporter. And I used to say back then, look, I said, well, I have to do these things because I have kids to support. And that was my excuse for doing stuff that I was not particularly proud of doing. I mean, I made a good, honest living, but I was not. So I said, I'm going to quit everything. I have enough money to live for a year, probably at the same, in the same standard of living and so forth, and see if I cannot get a job doing news exclusively. Forget quiz shows. Forget drama and all of that stuff. Do news. Be a reporter. And, of course, it was a chance that I took, and it's the best chance I ever took, obviously. Because that was... I was 38 years old when that happened.
When 60 Minutes started?
No.
Oh, it was before 60 Minutes, okay.
It was before 60 Minutes.
Oh, this is Nightbeat and the Mike Wallace show, right.
That's correct.
Right. No, so you became famous for interviews. On your own shows,
that's right.
And
I was anonymous prior. I was anonymous prior to Nightbeat, which was on a local television show here in New York, on Channel 5, and all of a sudden it became a New York hit. You know, New York is supposed to be a unwelcoming town, a tough town. Not true.
Now, let me ask you. I've heard like transcriptions, you know, like old recordings of radio mm-hmm. interviews from the 1930s, and maybe from the early 1940s, and they're basically scripted. You can hear the interviewer and interviewee literally reading scripts.
That's true,
right? And so when you started doing broadcast interviews, did you have models? Had you heard unscripted interviews, broadcast interviews?
I had not really heard. No. To that degree, I and the people I work with, a fellow by the name of Ted Yates, particularly, who was the my partner, the producer, we decided we were going to ask tough questions, abrasive questions. We were going to do a lot of research, and we were going to do it live on the air. I had an 11 o'clock newscast. And then what happened was we continued for another half hour after the 11 o'clock newscast on television, and all of a sudden, New York fell in love with it. And it was astonishing. This person, me, who was anonymous, suddenly became, hey, Mike, go get him.
One of the things you've become best known for in your 60 Minutes interviews is not only the tough interview, but what's been described as the ambush interview, where the camera person walks in with the camera running, and mm-hmm. and the person doesn't want to be interviewed, but the cameraman's mm-hmm. there with the camera on, and you see the person waving the camera away and putting their hands in front of their faces so that no one
right.
can see who they are, and you're asking questions even though they're trying to get rid of you. Have you ever had any reservations about that kind of interview? Have you ever thought that there's anything unethical about it? Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't think at the time that it was unethical. No, I mean, come on. I'm a reporter. You can't subpoena people to talk to you. If you write to them and try to call them on the phone and they don't answer and so forth, then take them unawares. The problem became this. We became a caricature of ourselves. We were after light, and it began to look as though we were after heat. Not to reveal some information or not to find out the story.
It turns into
the drama
theater.
It turns
into
theater.
It
was good theater. Uh-huh. It was good theater. But after a while, it became kind of predictable. And so finally, both Don Hewitt and I said, hey, enough of this. This is foolishness. Don being the producer of 60 Minutes. This is foolishness. And so we gave it up and have not. I still think it's a perfectly legitimate device to take somebody unaware and say, hey, there's a question that you ought to answer. There's a question you should answer. Matter of fact, maybe I'll, of course there'll be Secret Service men around, but maybe I'll do that with Dick Cheney.
Have you asked nicely yet?
Well, I have asked nicely. I have interviewed every president. I haven't interviewed many vice presidents, but I've interviewed every president since Abe Lincoln, with the exception of George W. Bush.
Yes, you say in your book that Karl Rove has never let you interview George W. Bush, even when George W. Bush was governor of Texas.
That's correct.
So why do
that's
you think that Karl Rove is standing between you and President Bush?
I was doing a piece down in Texas when he was governor about tort reform. And Karl Rove, who was his strategist, decided that we were not going to be... that it was going to be difficult for him to answer some of our questions. And so he said, no, you're not going to, Mr. Wallace, it was Mr. Rove and Mr. Wallace, you're not going to see the governor. He's not going to talk to you, simple as that. So we went ahead and did the piece and so forth. And then when he was finally elected president, we figured, well, come on, now he's president. Well, you know the White House and how secretive it is, how stonewalling it is, and since he's been president, I've tried and tried and tried. Fact of the matter is, I have never met the president of the United States. I interviewed his dad.
You have discussed and written about a problem that you've had with depression.
Mm-hmm.
When you realized what it was, did you mm-hmm. comprehend it? And I ask this because I think you're about 87 now, right?
And I'm going to be 88 next May.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people of your generation didn't grow up, you know, reading Freud and studying psychology and it being, you know, everybody wasn't in psychoanalysis or some kind of therapy. Things have really changed in terms of dealing with psychological issues, and certainly with depression, our understanding of the biochemistry of depression has
right.
changed enormously.
And the genetics.
And the genetics of it. Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I find really that a lot of people who are older and who didn't grow up with, you know, like studying psychology, and perhaps you did, don't really understand things like depression that well. You know, Like, you're happy or you're sad, and that's the way life is. And did you get it when you were diagnosed?
When I first began to not be able to eat happily mm-hmm. or sleep enough mm-hmm. or whatever, and had pains in my arms, I didn't understand it. I was going through a tough time. I was sitting. Have you ever been sued for libel?
Knock wood. No.
Good. She hasn't. Well, knock wood for you, because when you're sued for libel...
And this was the Westmoreland case that you're talking about.
That's exactly right. For $120 million, CBS and, among others, me, sued for libel and spent 4 months in a cold and drafty federal courtroom being called liar, cheat, fraud, etc., etc. I mean, I didn't realize what was happening, but I was sliding into a depression. My wife said, "Mike, you're depressed." I'm not. And my own doctor said, "No, don't you talk about yourself and depression. It would be bad for your image, Mike." Can you imagine?
Well, let me ask you. You say some people warned you that you couldn't talk publicly about your depression. It would be bad mm-hmm. for your image. And in fact, I mean, your image is of being the really tough questioner. Nothing gets
That's
to
right.
you, and you can ask anything to anyone. And so if people thought that you were vulnerable, that could, in fact, really affect your image. So did it. When you came out as having suffered from depression...
What happened was this.
Yeah.
What happened was this.
Mm-hmm.
1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning, you remember Bob Costas used to do a show called Later?
Yes.
He wanted to talk to me about 60 Minutes. And I asked him, who watches or who listens at 1:30 in the morning? And he said, well, some people who work at that time, but also people who get to sleep. And I said, oh, my people. and that's... He got so many answers, so many telephone calls, so many people who said, hey, that's what's going on with me. And you mean to say that Wallace, who apparently is doing his job and was a tough guy and so forth, he's not just a wimp. As a result of that, I figured, I'm going to go public. Of course, by that time, I was fairly well established doing what I do.
Yeah, I'll say. And speaking of doing what you do, you still do what you do, although you do less of it. But you are not quite retired yet. Why not? Why do you still want to be working at an age when most people choose not to?
Because it isn't work, as far as I'm concerned. Because it is fulfilling in all kinds of ways to do what I do. When I get up in the morning and I know that I have an interesting story that I'm working on, and I'm reasonably healthy, but my psychiatrist to whom I go for lube jobs every now and then has told me that... I'm sorry. It's still Dr. Kaplan and Mr. Wallace after 20, 25 years of this. He says, look, you have no overwhelming... You're not going to die right away. So you might as well get used to it. Keep working. Keep working.
Has having a psychiatrist for, 25 years, did you say?
Yeah. Yeah.
Has having been in psychotherapy or seeing a psychiatrist for 25 years... taught you anything about interviewing? Because I'm sure your psychiatrist asked you a lot of probing, interesting questions that get you thinking.
Mm-hmm. Of course it does. You suddenly realize that if you can persuade somebody, as he persuaded me, to talk candidly,
mm-hmm.
and look, your whole life, Terry, the way that you live teaches you. In jobs like yours and mine, I mean, it comes into play because it is useful, because it's part of what you learn as you go. Come on, I'm nearing the end of the road and still learning.
Mike Wallace, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Mike Wallace's new memoir is called Between You and Me. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.